JFY Networks continues our podcast focus on history this month with a conversation with Hubie Jones. Hubie has not only witnessed Boston history for 67 years, he has shaped and defined the civic and social landscape. He has been a leader in the formation, building, and rebuilding of at least 30 community organizations in neighborhoods across the city. In 1967, as director of the Roxbury Multi-Service Center, Hubie headed a formal investigation and published a report that led to the enactments of two landmark state laws, the Special Education Law and the Bilingual Education Law, protecting the rights to educational equity of two vulnerable groups. In this podcast, you'll hear how Hubie arrived in Boston in 1955 to discover a racially segregated city.
In the public life of the city, you didn't see the presence of black folks. Not at sporting events, not at Symphony Hall. They were basically missing in action, and that was bizarre. This was the city that I came into.
How he organized a one-day strike of black workers to protest the inequities of the time.
In April of 1963, I came up with the idea of having a one-day general strike called STOP, where we would ask all black people and our white allies to stay out of work for a day to protest all forms of racial discrimination in Boston.
And his view on how Judge Arthur Garrity's desegregation ruling changed Boston politics for the better.
There was a big boil. There was a big boil of racism in the middle of the Boston politics. And the court decision pierced the boil.
This podcast was created by JFY Networks, a Boston-based nonprofit provider of online learning resources, training, and support. JFY's individualized self-paced curriculum helps raise individual and school performance by maintaining grade-level skills and targeting unfinished learning. For JFY Networks, I'm Greg Cunningham. Hubie Jones has been a mainstay in Boston politics and civic leadership since his arrival in 1955. In a recent conversation with JFY's executive director, Gary Kaplan, Hubie recounted the history he witnessed and played an active role creating.
Well, Hubie, good morning, and it's a pleasure to see you again, as always. This is a great opportunity for us to get some of your thoughts down on tape and eventually in print. And I want to just start by setting the scene, which is that you arrived in Boston in 1955, and you have said, now that's a long time ago, and you have said that you think that Boston has made great progress in this last more than half a century that you've been here, and that you think Boston is poised to be a great city. Could you expand on that just a little bit? What gives you the feeling that Boston is poised to be a great city?
Well, when I came here in 1955, I was stunned by what I found. I found a city that was trying to come out of the economic doldrums. And it wasn't clear that it was going to succeed. Businesses had been leaving the city. There was no building of housing, et cetera, et cetera. It was in trouble. I also found a city which I called Up South because of the patterns of stark racial discrimination everywhere. If you went down to the shopping center stores downtown, Jordan Marsh or Filene's, there were no retail people serving you who were black or of color up front. They were either in the stock rooms or on the loading decks bringing in merchandise. There were no black motormen running subways. There were only five black bus drivers. You had a situation where blacks were basically segregated in the public housing system. In the public school system, there were very few black teachers. No black principals or headmasters. And there was basically a segregation going on that became fully noticed in the 1960s. in the public life of the city, you didn't see the presence of Black folks, not at sporting events, not at Symphony Hall. They were basically missing in action. And that was bizarre. This was the city that I came into. And you had also a parochialism that was entrenched, somewhat influenced by the hold of the Irish Catholic community that was suffocating. So this is part of what I found and was living with, you know, when I first got here. And of course, if you look 50 years later, you just see an amazingly different city, an amazingly different city. I mean, you had a situation where Black, well, the owners of the Red Sox and the Celtics basically had a practice that there could not be Black dominance on the ball field or on the basketball court. I remember the time that five Black players for the Celtics were on the basketball court at the same time, and the sports radio network went crazy. What do you think this is? We have the Black Knickerbockers here? You kidding me? We won't accept this.
They said that?
Yeah.
They said that on the radio?
On the radio. People calling in. Before they were shut down, this was expressed. Okay? So, and of course, when I go to a Celtics games today and see all these jerseys of Black players all over the place, okay? I say, wow, we've come to a different place, okay? During the time of the whole desegregation crisis, when you go to a Red Sox game or a Celtics game, particularly a Celtics game, it was like a giant Raw meeting. Remember Raw, Jimmy Kelly and Raw? It was like you had a giant Raw meeting.
Restore Our Alienated Rights.
Right.
Right, wasn't that?
That's right.
And that was Jimmy Kelly and who else?
Jimmy Kelly primarily. But what a lot of people didn't know was that the criminal class in South Boston kept those folks in line. And in fact, we later learned that Whitey Bulger had played a role in trying to burn down Garrity's house in Wellesley. Okay? So there was an element of the criminal class in South Boston that kept Roar and these folks in a particular posture.
In 55, John Hines was mayor, right?
Yeah, John Hines was mayor. He came into power when James Michael Curley, the mayor, was sent to jail for mail fraud. He was an administrative functionary in City Hall who was placed in power to be acting mayor, okay? And while he's acting mayor, he begins to do things that move away from the whole ward politics and power base that was established by James Michael Curley. So Curley comes back, and at the end of the day of his first day back in power in City Hall, he says to reporters, "I've done more in one day than John Hines has done in all the time I've been away. He's just a little secretary." Well, that insults John Hines. He's infuriated. And he decides to run against James Michael Curley. And he does, and he wins in 1949, okay? Now, James Michael Curley comes back and runs against him 2 years later, and Hines still beats him, okay? Now, Hines proved to be a different kind of politician and was more more accommodating to Black leaders and was trying to build a different kind of relationship with the business community, which he did, but he didn't have the political clout or the political skills he needed to really move the city big time. He wanted to build the Prudential Center as the symbol of the new Boston, okay, over this old railroad yard in the Back Bay that had been an environmental disaster, okay? And the Prudential Company said, "We're not going to build it unless we get a major tax concession from the State House." Well, Hines couldn't get it. He didn't know how to do it. And basically, the Prudential Company said, "Well, we built the foundation, but we're not going to build anything else. We're not going to put anything up on this thing until we get the tax concession." And that hole in the ground was a symbol of the lack of power that Hines had. or that I probably didn't have. And so he was gone as a mayor. And so in 1960, in comes John Collins, the tough guy, the guy who knows how to use political power. And John Hines gets from the State House and the legislature the concession needed for the Prudential Tower to be built. And it was.
How did he do that?
He did it. He did. How did he do it?
Yeah.
Well, he was a political figure who had been around a while, mm-hmm. in the State House. Okay. He was a state representative. So he had that kind of connection and so forth. And he knew how to trade.
He also did Government Center, right? Collins?
Did absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. Did Government Center.
Yeah, okay. And the West End.
And the West End. Yeah. No, the West End, the West End really was done under Hines.
It was.
It was done under Hines, mm-hmm. and it was a symbol of the worst kind of urban renewal ever. Because the people who lived there were moved out, okay? And never got back. Okay. It was urban renewal.
Removal.
Removal. That's what it was.
Urban renewal. So things were starting to move in that time period.
Yes. Things were starting to move. Okay. For Black Boston, really no. Okay. Because they had basically, well, Blacks didn't have political power. There was nobody in elected office. There's nobody in the mayoralty. They were involved in sort of advocacy that was sort of collaborative, and they were basically, the Black community was really not doing well and really frustrated. In comes the civil rights movement in the early 1960s, okay, coming up from the South, from Alabama, all the way to Maryland, all the way to Washington, into New York. And in June of 1963, it hits Boston big time when Ruth Batson of the NAACP and Paul Parks of the NAACP Education Committee makes their report to the Boston School Committee, the all-white school committee, okay, chaired by Louise Day Hicks. And they make it clear that there's de facto segregation in the Boston public schools that has to be corrected.
And that's the old elected school committee.
That's the old elected school.
The elected school committee. So
elected school committee.
Political animal.
Political animal. The elected school committee. And basically they said, we're not listening to you. We don't segregate kids in school. We basically assign them to schools nearest to their homes. Leave us alone. Your 14th point that we recognize de facto segregation, we won't do it. Well, they won't do it because they're getting political currency by having opposition to the black community, because they are making a promise to their white constituents. You stick with us, you keep voting for us, and you'll not have to worry about your children going to school with Black kids.
And Hubie, were the was the criminal element that you described before, Whitey Bulger and so forth, was that involved in all of that with the school committee?
I don't know, but it's hard to believe that there weren't elements of that, okay? Because basically when John Collins came into power and he had as his czar, the guy who was the head of the BRA, they tried to do urban renewal in South Boston. And South Boston said, we'll have none of it. You can't give us anything. We don't want you intruding in our community, in our tight-knit community with its politics. Now what, and ultimately they had to leave Collins and his czar, what is his name? My goodness, his czar, head of the BRA. How could I forget his name? They had to leave him alone. And they had a royal battle in Charlestown, okay, getting urban renewal accepted.
That was Ed Loeb.
Ed Loeb. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. How could you forget Ed Loeb? My God. It was Ed Loeb.
The Robert Moses of Boston.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. So they go to Charlestown, and Monsignor Lally is the head of the BRA. And he goes in there to try to convince Charlestown to buy urban renewal. And they say they don't want it. Okay. And they scream at Lally, take off your collar. You're a hypocrite. You're a hypocrite. Get out of here. We don't want this. Well, ultimately, they got urban renewal in Charlestown, barely, through all kinds of political maneuvers. All right. So that's a piece of what was happening.
During all this time, Hubie, what was the Globe? What was the Globe? We had a couple of newspapers, the Globe, the Herald. What were the newspapers? How were they handling all this?
Well, the Globe tried to get the school committee to really recognize what was going on for Blacks in the school system and to get them to accommodate having some conversations and so forth, and indicating that by not doing this, they were making this a bad scene for the city of Boston. It was going to end up with all kinds of conflict, all kinds of difficulties. So they were basically on the side of trying to get accommodation and trying to convince Louise A. Hicks and her crowd, you know, to really negotiate, but they'd have none of it, okay? Because it was giving them political currency, okay? You know, and after that school committee meeting on June 11th, which I was at, okay, where Parks and Ruth Bassett presented and the school committee said, get out of here, no.
1963.
And for that whole summer, there was wild demonstrations between at school committee headquarters, people were locked out of the building, demonstrators got into the building, stayed overnight, ultimately left when there was a bomb scare, all of that went on, okay?
Who were the leaders of the protest at that time?
Okay, well, Kenneth Guskett was the head of the NAACP. He was the president at that time. Melnia Cass was a big influence and the mother of Black leadership. She called herself the mother. Ruth Batson was obviously a person involved. Otto Snowden and Muriel Snowden were involved. It was a pitch battle, okay?
Was Mel in the picture yet at that time?
Yeah, Mel was in the picture. Now Mel was in the picture also with me because in April of 1963, I came up with the idea of having a one-day general strike called STOP, where we would ask all Black people and our white allies to stay out of work for a day to protest all forms of racial discrimination in Boston and not to ride the public transportation and not to shop. And I went to Mel King with the idea and he thought it was a great idea and he embraced it. And we brought in some other people to talk about it, including Tom Atkins, who was involved with the NAACP as their administrative secretary or whatever you want to call him. And he sort of bought it and it took off. The idea took off that we would have a stop day on June 26th. To protest all forms of racial discrimination in Boston. And the traditional Black leadership said, no, we're not going to support this. First of all, who are you, Hubie Jones, coming out of nowhere, believing you're going to lead a work stoppage?
What were you doing at the time, Hubie? What was your position?
I was working for the Boston Children's Service Association as a social group worker. I did have a group of young people I worked with who had all kinds of emotional problems in Roxbury. So that was my only connection with Roxbury. I was living in Newton, so there you go. And who are you? Okay. Well, I had Mel King with me.
What was he doing at the time? Mel?
Mel, he was working for the United South End Settlements as a social worker. He ran for school committee that summer, okay, in 1963. He stood up with me. At one point, Ken Guskett got so angry with me about this whole thing. He said he'd whip my ass if I persisted. I said, oh, really? Oh, really? Oh, okay. But it was basically, you don't get into leadership unless you go through the essential rituals of starting at the bottom and working your way up. You just don't come in and try to be a leader. They couldn't stop. They couldn't stop because it took off. People said they were going to stay out of work. And in fact, Attorney General Edward Brooke called a meeting on June 13th, 1963, where he called all Black leaders together to talk about all of the things that were popping loose, okay, in the Black community.
What was that date again?
It was the 13th.
June 13th. Sorry, go ahead.
So he called this meeting, and basically white leadership and business leadership go to him to say, look, take care of the natives in the black community, okay? Get in there and see what the hell's going on. You know, we can't deal with all this stuff. Okay. I mean I got calls directly from business people, you know, saying, hey, these folks are saying they're not coming to work at the Prudential Tower. You know, they're not gonna show up. Hey, I can't clean the office buildings down there. I said, well, that's the point. The point is we want you to understand what's going on here. But that's the point. Okay. So anyway, so Ed Brooke comes in to meet with all the black leaders. Okay. And I get a call saying, hey, Hubie, where are you? You better get down here to represent STOP, because he's going over all of these actions that are going forward, and the STOP's going to be coming up. So you better get here. I said, well, is Mel King in the room? Yeah, he's in the room. Well, tell Mel to hold the fort. I'll be there. So when I got there.
Why weren't you there in the first place?
I didn't know about the meeting.
They didn't let you know.
I didn't know about the meeting. I didn't know what the meeting.
They didn't want you there.
I don't know. All I know, I wasn't. I got there one hot June night, hot, the place steaming. There's Ed Brooke sitting in the front, you know, movie star, smooth, handsome, but he was ruffled that night because everybody was at him. I remember Alma Lewis sort of clawing at him. Ed, you don't understand what we're going through. These folks are giving us no choice but to have demonstrate and to come at them in very tough ways. We have no other course to do. You don't understand what's going on. So they asked me to stand up.
Where was the meeting?
It was at the St. Mark's Social Center. Okay. It was a social center for the St. Mark's Church, Congregational Church in Rossburg. So he says, what's this STOP thing? It says Ed Brooke. So I jump up and I say, okay, this is what STOP is. We're asking people to stay home. And this is the reasons. It protests all forms of immigration, blah, 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 blah. He says, well, if you shoot your ammunition and it's all over, what do you got? So he's making the case for the fact for not doing anything. I said, look, all I can tell you, this is beyond Mel King and me. The people out there in the streets are going to stay or out of work. Okay, there's nothing we can do about it, even if we wanted to, and we're not going to do anything about it. Okay, it's time to make it clear that we're not going to take this stuff anymore. Okay, so all of a sudden, up jumps Tom Atkins and says, "Look, something has to happen on June 26th because people are expecting something to happen. So why don't we turn this into a memorial service for Medgar Evers, who was murdered the day before in Mississippi? Let's have a memorial service on the Boston Common for Medgar Evers." And we say, fine, you have a memorial service? Great. We'll march the people who stay out of work to the Boston Common. Okay, so fine. Okay, so on the morning of the memorial service, which is on the 26th, stop day, we have like 500 people who show up at a rally at the park in Lower Roxbury. We then put everybody in line with Mel King and I leading a march down Columbus Avenue. We got police escorts and all that stuff down Columbus Avenue to the Boston Common. As we were marching down Columbus Avenue, we're waving to people who are hanging out of the windows, come on down, join us, come on down. And people started running out of their houses. So by the time we got to the Common, we had 1,000 people. So we marched around the Common, we didn't go right into the Common. We went all the way around Beacon Street, around past the State House, and people were stunned, looking at us with stony silence as we marched this group of 1,000 people around. And we finally get to the Parkman bandstand. And as the people who were there already saw us, they all stood up on their seats and started clapping. Tom Atkins, who was pissed, looks at me and says, take your folks and put them over. Take your folks and put them over there. Well, he thought STOP was dead. And so he was surprised that this whole thing came to life. Now, a agreement was made that I was supposed to speak at the memorial service, but I was never called on. So that happened. But the interesting thing was, is that September, after the March on Washington, which was a kind of a pause because everybody was going to the March on Washington. Of course, I didn't go because I was involved in something else with the Center Club, with a camp I was running for ex-mental patients. So Atkins in September throws an olive branch to the school committee saying, here's a plan for how you can desegregate the schools voluntarily by changing district lines, and there would not be any very much transportation of kids. Okay.
This is 1963.
1963 in September.
And the NAACP is proposing a desegregation plan.
Voluntary.
Voluntary. Holy cow.
Okay. And it would involve much transportation of kids. Louise Day Hicks rejects it, saying that constitutes gerrymandering and that's unconstitutional. We'll have nothing to do with it. Well, it was a lot of nonsense. What she knew was that she had political currency by standing in opposition to Black demands. And that September, she got more votes than John Collins, the popular sitting mayor, which proved that it was working.
In her reelection campaign for the school committee.
The whole committee, yeah. It's working for all of the folks. Now let's jump forward because
throw in a question. What was Collins doing all this time about all this stuff?
Collins was basically not doing anything.
Hiding out?
Basically he saw his role as redevelopment of the city. And he had done for Black folks what all he could do by his relationship with the Snowdens at Freedom House in giving them the urban renewal that they wanted in Washington Park in Roxbury. He had their support, and he was not going to be diverted from his rebuilding the city by getting involved in all of the wild stuff that was going on. So he stood athwart all of this, and he danced, okay? He made a decision to get involved in the middle of the politics of the school committee in any major way was not in his political interest. Now, he tried to do some things by putting one of his staff people in to try to get them to do the right thing and all of that, but it didn't work. So fast forward, you get to Garrity's decision to desegregate the Boston schools.
Who brought the suit?
NAACP. Brought the suit, Morgan versus Hennigan, okay? Hennigan being the school committee chair at that time, and ultimately was brought in 71. It took to 1974 for Garrity to build the case, and most people never read the case that he had built, which laid out how the school committee, brick by brick, built a segregated school system. And he had no other choice based upon the constitutionality involved but to call for a remedy, because this was de jure segregation, okay? And of course, he had a busing remedy. Now, you could raise issues about whether it was the right busing, blah, 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 blah. But anyway, a remedy had to be pursued.
Did he ever consider that redistricting proposal that had been brought forth 10 years earlier?
No, I guess not, because basically what he saw was throughout the system, a segregation thing going on in terms of hiring of teachers, principals, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It was just widespread. Now, after violence was visited upon the city, nobody would have ever asked our community to go through this. In times it looked like this, the city was coming apart at the seams. But one of the things that people couldn't see, and I would talk about, was that this resulted in the beginning of moderation of racial politics in the city. People couldn't see it.
Would you repeat that? This resulted in what?
The moderation of politics in the city. So that by 1983, you had Mel King running against Ray Flynn in a runoff for mayor.
Now, all this time, Kevin White is now mayor, right?
Kevin White.
In the 73, is that helpful?
Not really. But basically what happened was that Hicks and all of her white members of the school committee could not get reelected to anything again. Their constituents were through with them. She could not get reelected to anything.
Why? Why were their constituents through with them? Didn't they still have the same attitudes?
Because they had promised that they would never have to worry about going to school with black kids.
The
segregation meant that they had broken their promise. They had stayed with them politically. They had voted for them. It didn't work. They were through with them. Gonzo, all of them. Hicks, Kerrigan, you name it.
Palladino,
there you go. So the city began to move in a more moderate direction in terms of politics.
So are you saying, Hubie, that it took this whole paroxysm of violence to make that change happen?
What I in the book I was writing, which I was just reading a little bit of today in preparation for this, is that there was a big boil. It was a big boil of racism in the middle of the Boston politics. And the court decision pierced the boil. And out of the boil came awful pus. And the pus was violent. It had to be pierced. It had to be pierced. Or we would have never gotten to where we are today.
Hubie, this is a very interesting theory of political change.
It's my theory. I live by it.
Well, you lived through it. You lived through it. You observed it. I mean, this is very interesting.
So you get the city moving in a more moderate direction, okay? Mel King almost, he gets in a runoff. And as a result of challenging Ray Flynn becomes from South Boston, becomes a more moderate populist mayor. And in fact, I served on his committee, his education reform committee. I chaired it, in fact. And the committee ultimately recommended moving the school committee from an elected school committee to an appointed school committee. And the reason we did that was because the folks on the school committee were not doing their jobs. They were more interested in getting reelected and having these fundraisers, forcing people to go to their fundraisers. Okay, if you don't go to all your fundraisers, you're not getting a job in the, you're not getting any of the patronage here, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So we said, well, we looked at school systems all around the country, and we said, this is a cyclical deal. Some that had gone from elected to appointed, years later, that wasn't working. So they then came back to be elected again, which is probably what's going to happen now. Because we said eventually, so when we did this, a lot of people said, well, wait a minute, hey, Hubie Jones, you don't even live in Boston and you're taking away our vote. What are you doing? And I said, first of all, there was a referendum. You couldn't go from an elected school committee to an appointed school committee unless there was a referendum. There was a referendum and the residents of the community voted for an appointed school committee. Now that would be a different deal today with a referendum probably. So that was where we were. And it's always dangerous to do that because you're giving the mayor the power over the whole school committee. And if the mayor is not the right person, you're gonna have a lot of trouble. And we had a lot of nonsense at times with Menino. So it was a difficult choice, but it was made possible and done by Ray Flynn, who was under the pressure to be a more moderate populist mayor than we had in the past.
Wow. This is quite a chunk of history, Hubie. Quite a chunk of history. You know, I think this is a good place to stop for today.
Okay.
This is a whole lot to... This is 1955, and now we're at what year was that election? 82?
83.
Kevin White retires.
Retires.
20,000 people run for mayor. And in the preliminary, when Mel topped the field, did you go to the victory celebration at the Parker House that night?
No, I wasn't there.
I was there. It was ecstatic. People were just weeping. You know, it was so.
Oh,
and Mel topped the ticket. Yeah.
Well, the thing that's interesting in today's politics is that we have as mayor Michelle Wu.
Exactly.
Who, if you really look at look at what she did to get to be mayor, she basically built a rainbow coalition. Mel King was rainbow coalition politics. Well, she was able to defeat two impressive Black candidates because she had gone out quietly throughout the whole city, okay, in every community, and built the rainbow coalition that he was talking about, that Mel was talking about, which I think is fascinating, okay, because she did it and took out
two Black candidates and then a white candidate, the mainstream white candidate. Yeah. Okay, Hubie, thank you. We'll do this again and pick up where we left off and keep going. Thank you so much, Hubie.
We would like to thank Hubie Jones for joining us this month for the JFY Network's podcast. We plan to continue our conversation with him in the near future and hope you'll join us as he continues to share his experiences leading the campaign for racial and economic justice in the city of Boston. If you have any questions or comments, please navigate to our website, jfynet.org, which also features a wealth of commentary, dialogue, and free scholastic resources, including this monthly podcast, to support all educational communities. Thank you for joining us. For JFY Networks, I'm Greg Cunningham.